I do find a lot of organizations pushing that personal resilience piece in absence of looking at the root causes. And there's lots. It's like, is it horrible culture? Is it too much work? Is it a lack of autonomy over the work? Is it under-resourcing? There's all kinds of things that can cause it at the organizational level that if you don't fix, it doesn't matter how resilient that individual is, things are going to go off the rails.
The human experience is the greatest project any of us will undertake, yet it's often the one we spend the least amount of time working on. My name is Matt Johnston. I'm a self-professed personal development junkie, a retired pro golfer, and I now work for an organization that provides employee and health benefits to hundreds of thousands of people. It should be common sense to realize that what happens at work is what people bring home, and what happens at home comes to them to work. But that's too often ignored. That's why each week, I hope to uncover a little more around what it means to be a human, working and living in the 21st century. We'll be learning from experts, having conversations and getting insights into all those things that fall at the intersection of life and work, emotional and physical health, skills and money, all of the relationships we navigate each day, and of course, the purpose and meaning we all desire. This is The Human Assignment. Welcome back, or welcome to the Human Assignment podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. And if you're stumbling on us for the first time, welcome. We really appreciate you joining us. As always, I'm here with my co-host, Donna Harris, who is really running this podcast. And you've teed up another amazing interview. It was just a blast talking with Shelley Meadows today.
Yeah, she's so incredible. I was so happy to meet her through a training workshop that we did together, and grateful that she spent time with us today. She's got such a broad expertise and incredible experience. She's a certified human resources professional. She has an MBA, and she's also a chartered professional accountant. She spent over two decades in the professional services environment, where she rose to the executive level as a director, and has a breadth of experience primarily in the areas of regulatory compliance, risk management, and corporate restructuring. And she also has done an incredible amount of work developing, leading, and facilitating national and local training programs in a professional setting. So we had an incredible conversation about burnout, about leadership, and about her journey into the company that she started, Navigation Consulting and Training. And so many takeaways and a really fun conversation. So I can't say enough about the time we spent with her today.
It certainly was a fun conversation and insightful too. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging chat with our new friend, Shelley Meadows. Shelley, we're so excited to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
We covered this before we jumped on, but why don't we start with, where are you tuning in from today?
I am tuning in from Oakville, Ontario, just about half an hour or 2 hours, depending on the commute, west of Toronto.
Yeah, depending on the commute, hey? Yeah.
Yeah. It's always unpredictable.
I think I've got there in 25 minutes at one point, and it's 3 hours others. And Shelley, tell us a little bit about yourself. One of the questions we used to ask is, when we used to travel, and they ask you what you do for a living at the airport, how do you respond? So you can couch it in what you do, but just tell us a little bit about your story and what brought you here today.
Okay. I'm currently a partner at a company called Navigation Consulting and Training. Right now, a lot of our work is in workplace harassment investigations, but we also do leadership training, coaching, anything HR. My partner, Martin Franchi, does health and safety training as well. So it's really about the business imperative and supporting healthy and safe work environments is what the company itself is about. My journey was a little bit circuitous to get there. By training, I am a chartered professional accountant. I have an MBA. I recently got my certified HR professional designation. I met Donna actually recently getting my certified, the psychological health and safety advisor. So, you know, designations up and down, all around town. That's the boring on paper part. I talked to Donna about being, I sort of self-profess I'm a recovering type A personality, which is the journey that led me to founding Navigation Consulting and Training.
And we've chatted a little bit before, so I know your story, but I think it's a a really powerful one for a number of reasons. So can you just tell us a little bit about the exit from perhaps the high pressure sort of corporate environment you were in? And now, not that having your own company is not high pressure, because it is in very different ways. But if you could just tell us a little bit about how you exited and what brought you to that and some of your experiences that way.
Absolutely. I guess I'd had a 24-year career in accounting profession at one of the big four firms, Ernst & Young. And I had become a director at Ernst & Young. In that time, I went through the sort of traditional audit. I'd done around a decade of corporate restructuring. And actually, that was another designation I have. I'm not sure. I think I mentioned it. So I did restructuring work when there weren't a lot of females in restructuring. Then I had children and found that I needed more balance. The 80 to 90 hour work weeks weren't working for me. With kids, imagine that. And so I went internal into sort of a corporate compliance role. So it was called risk management, where we were doing a lot of policy review, training, regulatory compliance and testing. And so that's how I ended up getting into the training group. But with that, the hours slowly increased. When I came back after kids, the regulatory pressures and continued to increase. And sure enough, that slowly started to be back into an 80-hour work week again. And I think I just ignored all the possible signs of burnout. Like, I'm a consummate overachiever in everything, and burnout was no different. I just ignored until it was like fantastic burnout. So I found out because someone on my team had a blood pressure issue. So we started the team going down to a different floor. We could go down floors and test our blood pressure and our heart rate. So we started doing that as a team. The idea being we'd walk down the stairs of 10 floors and up the stairs 10 floors. Often I'd cheat. I'd walk 5 and take the elevator 5 on the up. I'd always walk down, maybe not the up so much. Or if I was in a real hurry, I would just take the elevator up to 10. And, you know, the team would often just meet me because they'd walk and they were really good. Anyways, I digress. We were going down and taking a test, and pretty much regularly every day, most of my team, their heart rate would be around 70 to 80. And there was not a single day that mine registered less than about 125 beats per minute. So I remember my team kind of looking at me saying, "Are you okay? Do you feel okay?" And my reaction was, "Yeah, I feel the same as I do every day. Like every minute, I don't feel like it's racing." So I bought myself a Fitbit and invested in that, and quickly realized that my heart rate really almost never went below 100. And in fact, it was recording exercise when I was sitting at my desk. And trust me, I wasn't exercising. I was sitting at a desk. I've been sitting at a desk for, at this point, you know, 24 years. But it just was so, for me, I had ignored burnout so long, the old theory of lean in. And I just had been leaning in really, really long and not recognizing it, to the point that, you know, I ignored every possible sign. I think years later, more recently, my daughter was sort of helping me clean out a medicine cabinet at some point. She's like, "Mom, all these like medications, what's with that?" And you sort of reflect back and look, it's like, yeah, I guess like every little issue that came up, there was always a pill that could mask the symptoms. Mm. And so I just, again, ignored. Well, when you get it, finally, I was diagnosed with tachycardia, which is the too fast heart rate. You can't really deny it anymore. So, you know, a series of events happened at the office, and I still continued to push while my doctor said, you need to take some downtime. And it wasn't until certain events happened one day where I finally just said, enough is enough. Okay. You know, something happened at work. I didn't feel very supported. And I just sort of said, actually, I was in a car accident. I was supposed to be presenting in front of national, just an audio with some of the executives, and got hit by an Uber that morning and made it in with like 5 minutes spare to go live. And not one person actually asked me how I was doing and if I was okay to go live or not. And suddenly it was the epiphany of, well, like I've been giving my all to this. They knew I was in a car accident. Not one asked if I was okay. And at that point, I was like, okay, I finished it and sort of said, I'm going home and I'm going to, you know, actually I was going to the reporting center because I hadn't had time to do that in the morning. And that was sort of the beginning of it. Another couple series of events happened in the office. And then finally, I just said, you know, I need 2 weeks off. I'm going to take 2 weeks off because I need to sort of take some downtime, because I was really fraying at that point. I was just exhausted. It wasn't just the tachycardia. It was, I actually was feeling quite exhausted. And a year and a half later, I finally got medically cleared to go back, which was stunning for me that it actually took that long for the heart rate to come down enough. And then you just said, how did it leave me there? When I was finally medically cleared a year and a half later, my job wasn't there. So I ended up parting ways with EY in what I now view as a silver lining. Like, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I wouldn't have had the courage to leave the job and the career, because I defined myself by the title and the income. And I was just, my whole persona and who I was so wrapped up in my career that I wouldn't have been able to walk away any other way. So I guess Mother Nature has a fabulous way of clocking us over the head when we don't listen to her for years. And that led me to a better place with navigation consulting and training.
I have several follow-up questions. Oh, sorry. Okay. I think, and Matt does too, but
I know I ran long. Sorry.
No, it's beautiful. It's perfect. Just before we go on several tangents, I want to acknowledge that the courage it takes to leave, and sometimes the universe forcefully tells us there's another plan for us. But without that forceful, quote unquote, kick in the ass, I just want to acknowledge that that is really hard. And we'll dig into that for sure in a second. But just, yeah, there's obviously a huge personal cost to burnout in terms of our physical and emotional health and our overall well-being. But there's also a significant cost to the organization when organizations aren't necessarily able to support people or help people circumnavigate burnout. So can you just talk about the actual hard cost to your organization? I know that you mentioned that there was other people at the time who were also exiting or taking leaves, and there's actual hard cost to the organization in addition to the corporate knowledge and expertise that is lost while someone is on leave or when someone exits.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, the benefits provider, it was funny, had said that, you know, the big four accounting firms have an unusually high stress leave / burnout rate. So it wasn't really unusual. But yeah, I mean, it's the standard costs, right? And they're the big ones, but they're hard to... They're hard to quantify, but they're not really. Absenteeism, if people aren't there, then they can't work and productivity goes down. Even when they're there, presenteeism you get, which is loss of productivity. The work doesn't get done or doesn't get done as effectively. There's a lot of spinning. You can't necessarily concentrate. You're not coming to work with your best self when you're in the process of burning out, let alone when you actually hit that magical wall of burnout, which, you know, I say the magical wall because it doesn't really exist. It's not a wall. I think it's a journey towards it. So it's the attrition, turnover, you have people leaving, and then the hard cost is severance. I mean, well, fortunate or unfortunate, I don't know. I always look at it as fortunate, I tend to. I was there 24 years, my husband's a labor and employment lawyer, so you do the math. Right? As I say, I had lots of time where I was paid that I could come up with the idea and concept for navigation consulting and training, where the firm was still paying me while having to pay and recruit a replacement. I mean, I think I found out later that my role kind of got split up between a number of people. So it meant more staffing. It's the cost of retraining. And it's the loss of institutional knowledge as well. And that's really hard to put a price on. Someone's been there and worked in the environment for 24 years and has become an expert in the field, particularly in what I was doing, the boring land of auditor independence. It's a pretty highly specialized knowledge and understanding. And so to find that skill set in someone else takes a long time. So that loss of productivity, again, getting someone new up the learning curve is huge. I think organizations sort of underestimate. We're a little bit myopic in that we sort of say we can't afford to have more people. And so we push our people. Sometimes we push our people too hard. Well, then if you get burnout, now you're paying for two people. Anyways, where maybe if you were proactive about it, you could pay for a person and a half instead of, you know, having all that loss of productivity potential. It should never really come to that. No one should actually lose their job because they've been totally burnt out by their organization. But, you know, that's the reality. Sometimes that happens. Like, I can't fault them with me taking a year and a half. And it's not me taking it, my body taking a year and a half to recover enough. I can't fault them for needing to move on. That's the reality of business. they need to move on. But sure, if you could, in hindsight, 2020, could you go back if I had been better supported, had they recognized the signs of burnout and supported me better so that I didn't burn out, they could have saved a ton of money. I also wouldn't have found the happier place that I'm in now. So as I say, I tend to look at it as it's a silver lining. It's just sort of from a health standpoint, a shame it didn't happen 10 years earlier for me, but you know, c'est la vie.
We're going to dig into the work that you're doing at Navigation. And as Donna said, there's all sorts of questions that we don't even have time to ask. I just want to also acknowledge and thank you so much for sharing your experience and story. Luckily, we're talking more about burnout now, and it's generally a part of the zeitgeist, but there's also a lot of confusion around it.
Yeah.
And so, as you said before, with your distinctions, like you have, like we could do a crossword puzzle with the letters behind your name, and and you're just had this incredible career, worked for a top four consulting firm. And so, you know, I think that it's important for, this is something that most of us are probably feeling and have gone through in different degrees. And so for you to be able to share your story, what you've gone through, what you've learned along the way is really helpful for all of us. So thanks so much. Before we start to dig into it, I just want to acknowledge how much we appreciate you sharing that.
Well, you know what? And I'm happy to, Matt. And one of the things I want to say, like, I think it's important for people to share it. I know that with stress and burnout, anxiety and depression often get sort of are part of that sphere as well. People are afraid to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because it has a stigma of shame, of failure. And, you know, it's kind of like the elephant in the room, especially with COVID. As you said, so many people are going through it, but people in a senior position don't want to talk about it because then it just seems like you're failing. And it goes against that whole lean in principle that people have. I truly believe it's really important for us to talk about it. It is the elephant in the room, right? No different than I remember when I had a miscarriage early on and no one talked about it because it was such a shame. The more I talked about it, the more I learned other people had experienced and how many other people had experienced it. And so stress and burnout, I find is the same thing. And it gives us permission to talk about it with people that we know are open and have lived experience with going through it. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
The type A piece, I just want to press on that too.
Oh, yeah.
Like I think as type A'ers, you almost wear that as a badge of honor. Like I laughed when you talked about the Fitbit, that the Fitbit was registering you working out at your desk. I'm like, what a classic type A move too. It's like, oh, you know what? I found a way through anxiety to actually get my exercise while returning emails. It's just...
Yeah, look at that. Except, you know, the body shape and the weight told me otherwise. It was like, oh, look, you're exercising like a fiend. You're burning calories. Except no, this is a podcast. You can't see. But at the time, actually, I'm better now. But at the time, I certainly had the, you know, sit in office desk weight going on for sure.
Can you talk about what's different now? Because as a type A-er, I work in this area. Like I study this stuff all the time. And I watched myself this morning trying to fit in 15 things when there was room for five. I know deep down that high performance does not occur when I'm playing the game of whack-a-mole, but I just inevitably go there as a default. And so I'm curious what life looks like now for you.
You know, to your point, it's hardwired. You're a type A. I say recovering type A because I'll probably always be a type A. It is trying to be a little more mindful about the, you know, one step, hopefully it's two step forward, one step back. I still do. Like just over the weekend, I was working on something for going back to spreadsheets and accounting for someone in my family. And I stayed up till 4 a.m. working on it. But you can slip into it very easily, right? So part of it is having a business partner who is not a type A, who holds me more accountable to things. So reminds me when I'm getting a little bit too invested and lost in things, because that's what you do. Like you become a little bit, you're in the groove and you just keep doing it. It's just one more thing. It's one more thing, or it's balancing multiple things. So now it's about taking on work when I know that I have time to do the work. It's taking on work that I love doing and that I enjoy. It's not doing things that I don't enjoy doing, outsourcing some things where I don't like doing them, but trying to remind myself to take the downtime and find the escape that actually does allow you the chance to unplug your brain. Some days I'm better at it than others. some days, quite frankly, I suck at it and I just go back to being, you know, type A Shelley, but you just keep plugging along and you hope that every day you get better. You know, once you hit a certain age, the 4 a.m. stuff, your body's pretty good at reminding you the next day that you're not that young anymore and you can't do the all-nighters. So it's a good reminder, bit of a, you know, Donna said, bit of the kick in the ass. It's the next day. It's like, oh, not so productive today, am I? It's always sort of challenging. And sometimes it's asking you the question, do I need to be doing this right now? Am I putting a deadline on it that is necessary? Or can I take more time to do things? So I find a lot of, and again, if you go back to, I draw on a lot, the professional experience I had, there was a lot of false deadlines or not pushing back on deadlines. You could give people more time, but the constant pressure to overachieve for the clients. Some partners were better at, and directors were better at it than others in pushing back. So I think it's the questioning, the, is this necessary? And do I have to get all these things done? When your to-do list is, you know, someone, I just saw something online I was watching and said, if your to-do list has 17 priorities on it, maybe they're not all priorities. It's about how many balls do you have? How many balls do you allow yourself to be throwing in the air at a time?
Mm. I love how you talk about like some days are good and some days are not or whatever. And especially if you're a type A person, you should be like, okay, I have been made aware of this and now I'm going to work on this skill and I'm going to nail it every day. And then you're, quite frankly, sorry for using the word ass so much, then your ass gets handed to you and you're like, oh my God, I suck. Why can't I, like, it's life, right? And so like undo your wirings. I just want to acknowledge that I think the more we can say that to people, like, and I've experienced, we've talked about our experiences, right? Like I've been knocked down and taken months to recover also. I find like the experience of that prevents me from getting to that point again, but it doesn't mean that right. I don't like, you know, have meltdowns in my kitchen because I'm like, oh my God, how did I do this again? How did I say yes without thinking? I just wrote an article about that 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Didn't listen.
It's always easier do as I say, not as I do. Right.
Jeepers.
And I have to admit, like I was classic for it, but now I actually teach it in terms of leadership needing to model the behavior, but you're right, looking at it for yourself. But I can remember like at EY saying to the staff, like I would watch and they'd be working too much. And I actually remember one day, one of them, she's like, I have to just get this done. I'm like, no, you have to go for lunch. She's like, no, I have to get this done. I'm like, no, you're going for lunch. And I physically grabbed the binder and said, I'm going to lock this binder with me in my office. You're going to go and take lunch, right? And so I would do that for the staff and I would tell them to do that. It never occurred to me in the moment that I was modeling totally opposite behavior than what I was telling them to do. Mm. So I didn't take lunch. Some days it was like 3 o'clock. I hadn't had anything to eat. I hadn't even gone to the bathroom because, you know, if you don't eat or drink, you don't have to. I would let people follow me into the bathroom because that was the 5 minutes I had spare and they still needed to consult. So it's that kind of life. And I did allow it to happen while telling other people and trying to take care of my staff, telling them not to do it. As leaders, it is so important for us to model better behavior than that, right? Mm. But you have to hold up the mirror and look in it. And not all of us love looking in the mirror, right?
Yeah. And one of the things that you and I talked about before is how organizations, when it comes to burnout, tend to reward bad behavior, but not reward good behavior. And I think you just talked or gave an example of that, like, right, where you're like, as a leader, I'm trying to help you. But as a leader, you were probably also rewarded for keeping the hours that you kept. And so can you talk a little bit about that in terms of as leaders, leaders need to, you know, emulate that behavior and take care of themselves. But I think there's an organizational role as well, right, in terms of protecting people from themselves to some degree.
Absolutely. And I think that's a perfect way of putting it, protecting people from themselves. And it's not everyone that needs the protecting, but certainly the type A personalities that tend to be, you know, Bay Street kind of thing do need that protecting. I had 5 weeks of vacation a year. I couldn't use it. Like, it's great. You gave me a benefit, but every year I would be, you know, approved for carryover, which was on an exceptional basis, except I was an exception every single year. It got carried over. Yeah. And the working hours, like I can remember, it was very heady days, right? Like I was in my, it was probably in my 20s doing corporate restructuring work. Some of Canada's largest corporate restructurings at the time, like Eaton's and Cineplex, Laidlaw. And they were working those 80 to 90 hour weeks. And then, you know, the bonus check would just appear because you were working so hard. It's like, keep the money coming, keep the money coming. It's like, oh, if I keep doing this, it's that, you know, I think it's the Pavlov's training. It's the, if I just keep killing myself, the money keeps pouring in. Oh, and I get promoted, I get a new title, and I'm zooming up the ranks. And it just reinforces that. So it created that culture of basically, in a way, in hindsight, you look back at it, and it's, you and I, Donna, you brought up the example of the boiled frog. You don't know when you're in it, right? But at the time, you just didn't see it, that they were basically grooming and rewarding that burnout behavior in a way, mm-hmm. when you look back over the years. And I think a lot of the accounting firms, law firms are classic for doing it. I see that there is a change going on. They're recognizing they're increasing, but again, it's how you do it. You know, just throwing money at personal resilience and increasing your benefit plans doesn't address the root cause. So, you know, it's a question of how do you actually get there?
It's such a nuanced topic. Donna, your research obviously does a really good job of speaking to burnout. When Donna's research, which Shelley, I think you're aware of, studying some Olympic coaches. What I find so interesting about Donna's research is that those Olympic coaches support the athletes that are competing at the highest levels. And we just know because of science that you have to create periodization schedules and, you know, really monitor inputs and recovery to make sure that they perform at their best. And in business, we understand the same thing in terms of the mechanisms at play, the machinery, if that's within your business, just how much you can push it and before it, you know, it like what that sweet spot is for, you know, whatever, a high cost machine, the most valuable resource.
Profit and loss, profit and loss.
But I think with, you know, ourselves, and obviously, you know, generally we're looking around at people when you talk about the reward systems, it's hard to remind ourselves that like, we're not going to get the best from ourselves and from others if we don't have a recovery aspect to what we're doing, if we don't think of ourselves in the same light. But it's really nuanced because what you're talking about is not throwing high performance out the window. It's actually the answer to high performance.
Absolutely. And that's where Donna and I had really connected in the course that we were taking, because although she was speaking in my language, you know, she's speaking in the sports world, which I just can't relate to being a desk jockey. But it was the whole discussion is the same language. So it's that performance optimization. So that's a vernacular that a business person understands. If I use the general term, which is self-care, some people cringe and they're like, oh, like kumbaya yoga kind of stuff. And I'm just going to roll my eyes and that just costs money and it's all very kumbaya. No. If I use the word performance optimization and I talk to you about like the analogies Donna was using, talking about the sports and how you need downtime to perform at your peak, if we can get that into the mindset of business organizations and business leadership, I think that's the language that they can understand. It's sad. Like you have to kind of disguise it as something that sounds sexy, like it's, you know, profit, loss, bottom line. And use that sort of performance optimization language when all you're really talking about is people taking care of themselves and you supporting that.
Yeah.
But we can get to that language once they understand it in the language that they're comfortable operating in and that it ties down to the bottom line. Mm. Like at the end of the day, heart of hearts, I'm still an accountant. The bottom line matters to me. So if someone wants to look at me and say, oh yeah, but you don't get it, you just think all this is in, you'll just throw money at it. No. I actually believe in the business imperative of this and the fact that if you invest in your people's health, it actually pays dividends in the end. Not maybe in the dollars and cents that you immediately calculate. We're looking at the wrong metrics. We're looking at the pure cost of salary. It's very hard to measure in a professional services environment, or a bank or anything like that, it's very hard to measure the output of a person. And so that loss of efficiency, turnover and absenteeism, if you don't relate that back to health, and it goes beyond, I mean, it's corporate culture, it's all that, but I believe corporate culture also plays a very, very important role in people's wellness in the workplace and impacts the bottom line as well. So I will always be dollars driven, sadly. It's a bit of a weird dynamic with me.
I think the culture piece is really important to touch on, but I also think, just to go back to the sport analogy, and we talk about, and even with coaches, right? You talk to coaches about self-care and they're like, oh God.
Yeah.
I don't have time for that. And when I ask them to explain their athlete recovery protocols, right, they can go on and on, because like keeping your athletes healthy is the same thing as keeping your staff healthy. It's asset management is what you're doing. Right?
Exactly. And asset management. Perfect. That is the right word. Yes.
Right. Because if you go back to like when we talked about your exit from your corporate role, right, there was obviously the cost to you from a health perspective, but there was two huge costs to your organization. One being the hard cost of severance, and two, which is, you know, hard to measure, but also a hard cost of like 25 years of corporate knowledge and expertise, right? Yes. So it's like there's a huge asset in each individual.
Yes.
But on the culture side, what's interesting is that if you can talk about performance optimization and high performance and human performance, I mean, pick the term that works for you, right? But human performance is human performance. I mean, it's going to look different in terms of the preparation and management if you're trying to prepare someone to get on the podium at the Olympics, or if you just want someone to be in a sustained high-performing director role in a professional services organization. But there's principles that are the same, and those principles are undulation and load and elements of recovery. And recovery doesn't mean 10 weeks off. Recovery can be anything from 15 minutes of a short meditation or just simply actually eating your lunch. Like this, we're not talking about like crazy stuff here, right? Or like actually leaving your building, walking outside, breathing fresh air for 5 minutes and returning to your desk are micro moments of recovery. But you have to create cultures where there's permission to do that and it becomes acceptable behavior. And that is a leadership piece, but it's also a cultural piece, because if we feel like it's, oh, I can't leave my desk, I can't leave my desk, well, then you're going to end up with a bunch of people who are hangry by 3 o'clock and not performing well on a daily basis. And cumulatively, that's going to have huge havoc on their health and their overall performance in the long term. So the principles are the same, but the protocols look quite different, you know, like from preparing an 800 meter athlete to run fast at the Olympics, you're not going to prepare an executive to do that by any stretch of the imagination. There's elements that are the same, and that undulation and load and those elements of recovery would be the two key things there that I think make sense.
Absolutely. Anyways. Absolutely. I think that's exactly the important element that sort of jogged with me when we were first talking. You'd be horrified, Donna, to see my overhead bin when I was at EY. It was all the, you know, requisite binders and papers and all that stuff. But in between the nooks and crannies was Easy Mac, Triscuit crackers, and soup to go. Like anything that I could heat in the microwave in a minute or less so that I could actually eat while I continue to sit at my desk, Matt, while registering exercise on my Fitbit. I was doing it all at once, but really not very good for my health. I had a partner actually at EY at one point say to me, this was when I was in corporate restructuring, a man I had a huge amount of respect for. And he said to me, Shelley, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And it's such a funny saying, because first of all, my reaction was, I'm not a runner. I don't want to do either. But, you know, now it's the analogy of sometimes you need to run a marathon. Sometimes you need to run a sprint. You need to know which one you're training for and which one you're getting yourself ready for. And you can't keep doing sprint after sprint after sprint after sprint without the recovery. Mm-hmm. And then linking those sprints together and saying, well, I just ran a marathon at sprint pace. Look at that. And that's pretty much what I was doing, I think, at work all the time, was constant sprints to the point of a marathon and just not never taking that time to recover. But, you know, again, I was the one in yoga class at some point in time, I think I was pregnant, realizing I needed to take some time. I took a yoga class and I'm the one lying on the yoga mat as they're saying, you know, relax your eyelashes and relax this and that. And I'm like sitting there going, come on. I'm making my list of 17 priority items that I need to be getting done in that moment because I don't have time to be lying on the mat. now in hindsight, I look back and I'm like, wow, if I'd been smart, I actually would have listened to it and done it and taken the time. I found actually a good company, mindmanagement.com, and it's mind, M-I-N-D, and it's MGT.com. Hmm. And they kind of spoke my language. This is more recently, in that they do meditation. And again, meditation, I suck at it. Like, it's just not my thing. I always used to sort of, you know, think it was silly and a waste of time because I'm a type A and I need to be doing things. But, you know, they do small chunks. And so it's just, you know, they might have a 2-minute thing or less than. So I listen to those before I get on the phone with my mom to relax a bit. But I found, again, from a corporate standpoint, like sitting in an hour yoga class, you're not going to get a type A person to do that.
Right.
Unless they really understand the importance of what you talked about, Donna, the load and recovery. But you might get them for 5 minutes or 2 minutes. And 2 minutes can become 5 minutes, which can become 10 minutes. So it's all about starting small and building on it in terms of what it is. And it doesn't have to be yoga and meditation. Like, it can be something else. So for me, what I learned early on was being by, and Donna, you have it as well, the being by the water. So for me, it doesn't matter if I'm walking by the water, which I can do now where I live now, which is great. But I used to have Tuesday nights where I go sailing. And it was the one for quite a few years, I actually stopped. I didn't go sailing because I was too busy at work and too busy in my career and achieving and moving ahead. Towards the latter part at EY, I did take Tuesdays where I would walk out of the office at 4:30. And I stopped feeling guilty about it because I'd been up at 3 a.m. answering emails. And I said, you know, at 4:30 on Tuesdays, I'm gone. I'll be in the water. There's a period of 3 hours I won't be responding to. And I would just get a breath of nothingness. Like, you're focusing on the race. Really, I was just focusing on not being at the office and being able to shut the brain down for a bit. Now, often I would then, you know, as soon as I set my feet back on land, I'd be back on the, at the time, the BlackBerry, the crackberry and emailing people. Or I would often skip the dinner and then go back to the office. And I don't do that anymore. Now it's Tuesday night is sailing night and that's it. And then I have dinner with the crew and I enjoy it a lot more. It's finding those moments that you actually enjoy that I think are very important.
You know, what I'm getting here too is that we all create our own recipe. Like, it's yoga and meditation, or pick your kale shakes, are all part of the what we think of.
Did you say kale shakes?
When we think of
kale, is horrible and shouldn't be in anything, let alone shakes. Shame on you, Matt.
It's all part of the to my point. Thank you for that sort of emphasizing. It is all sort of, you open a wellness ad and you know, this is what's being promoted. At the end of the day, you know, if that's your jam, rock on.
Yeah.
But if it's going to the lake, it's a time with kids, maybe an 8 hour sleep every night, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Imagine that. Oh, that's the unicorn. The 8 hour sleep is the mythical unicorn, I'm convinced. But yes, it would be great. I used to go to the movies. That was the other thing. Yeah. I'd go to the movies and check out. And now people make fun of me because they're like, did you see this movie? I'm like, I think so. Like, do you remember it? I'm like, no. Because it was like the only time I would let my brain just shut off. Right, is at the movies or on the water. You're right. It's finding your personal space and what works for you. Yeah. But I think that's what employers need to keep in mind too. And I think that's where benefit programs, things like that, come into play, to the extent that they can be flexible for people and offer different things. It's really important because everyone has to make something that works for them or it's not going to work, to be quite honest.
I just wanted to reiterate what both of you are saying. I think there's, you know, we talk about recovery for me is not recovery for the next person, right? I mean, even someone who's introverted and extroverted in terms of where they get their energy from, right? For some people, going out and being around tons of people and in a crowd like energizes them and gives them that break. And for other people who are wired differently, like, that's actually doubly exhausting. So I think that it's just that acknowledging that there's individuality. And so it's not a one size fits all, to your point, right? Like, so meditation is wonderful for some people, but it's not for everyone. And same with yoga or like, you know, I need to do a super intense, fast, hard run a couple times a week. Yeah. And there's lots of people who are like, no, my husband being one of them, right? So I think it's just really interesting to keep that in mind. And I think we didn't dive into it, but when you talked about, you know, burnout and sort of like, you can do resilience training and you can sort of try to empower people, but if you don't address the root cause, so is the root cause sort of this individuality piece and that abilities to sustain yourself? I just want to bring you back to the root cause, because I have a feeling it's related to what we just talked about.
Yeah, I think there's two different things. So there is the personal side of it. We can be our own worst enemy. Type A personalities can push too hard. I think personal resilience is extremely important. It absolutely is. You have to be able to deal with change. You have to be able to deal with failure, and you have to be able to move on and accept it. And if you can actually package it up and see that as, you know, a really good learning experience, all the better. So I think the personal resilience piece is critical. We all have to have it. Stress happens. Like, you can't get away from it. It's unavoidable, right? But I do find a lot of organizations pushing that personal resilience piece in absence of looking at the root causes. And there's lots. It's like, is it horrible culture? Is it too much work? Is it a lack of autonomy over the work? Is it under-resourcing? There's all kinds of things that can cause it at the organizational level that if you don't fix, it doesn't matter how resilient that individual is, things are going to go off the rails, right? Mm-hmm. There's different ways of looking at it. You talk about, if you want to do the race car driver, there's the race car driver that wants to go an extra lap and pushes too hard. Well, if the team at the home base isn't saying, you're going to burn your tires, you have to pit, like you have to pit, then that driver is going to keep going. They're going to lose the race because they don't pit and the car is going to have a problem. Likewise, if a driver decides he needs to pit because they need some help and the pit crew isn't there, they're not going to win the race either, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the two things working together that are really important. And I think organizations right now, and part of it may just be, you know, COVID fatigue, and we've had so much change in such a short period of time. So we're just sort of, sometimes you flail a bit and throw whatever you can to see if it works. But we put all our eggs in the personal resilience basket. I'm not saying it's a bad basket. It's an important basket. But to look at those root causes, do I need to resource more? Do I have individuals that need to take time out? We talk about high performers. When you have stuff you need done, who do you go to? Your high performer that you know can get it done. And then before you know it, the high performers actually have disproportionate workload. Mm. And not only that, you've disenfranchised other people that maybe you had an opportunity to train and to give opportunities to that could be better and could have thrived and become a high performer, but you've been too busy focusing on the one person that's, you know, I was known as, it was the get her done girl, right? Like, give it to Shelley, she'll get it done. Like, do that. And never saying no. So there's two pieces, right? It's the, I always go to the person who doesn't say no. Well, I'm a little bit culpable in that. If I overload someone without recognizing that I'm overloading them, or if they're actually actively saying to me, you're overloading me, and I'm going, well, who else is going to do it? And you do the best job. Like, can you just, you know, one more thing, we'll get through this. We'll get through this. Except when we get through this, there's another thing waiting. So I think that's the root cause piece that a lot of organizations need to look at is, why are my people burning out? What can I do to make it better? And that leadership piece is, are my leaders modeling the right behaviors and rewarding the right behaviors and not rewarding behaviors that actually can be long-term problematic because they lead to burnout or poor culture?
Just to take this a little bit further, because that's so helpful from an organization standpoint. I've jotted down some notes as you're talking here. As we're, the dynamics of work have obviously changed forever, and most organizations are either now moving to a distributed culture or a hybrid workforce. I see this for myself with the teams that I work on. It seems to be more challenging when you're all in a room. It takes a different skill set. When you're all in a room, you can see how people are doing, if they're, you know, mm-hmm. the mood that they're in, their workload, if they're in early and staying really late. It seems to take a different skill set to lead in a distributed hybrid work environment. What are you telling organizations? What are your recommendations?
For sure, it does. Absolutely. It's the what training have you given your leaders and your managers to actually do that differently? And a lot of people didn't give any kind of training on that. Like, it's just sort of left to figure it out. And that doesn't always work. So, you know, at one client, I talked to a manager who basically disavowed any responsibility for a performance review for someone because they haven't physically been in the location for a year and a half. And it's like, you what? Like, but you're still their supervisor. And just because they weren't working physically in the location doesn't mean like you're still responsible for them. Hmm. And this person said, well, they didn't reach out to me. It's like, you're the supervisor. You need to reach out to them. Like, it's different touch points. And yeah, where, you know, in the old space, you'd walk down the hall and check in on people. Well, unfortunately, it's the ugly life of Zoom, but it's still a check-in and a touch point, or it's a message. Hey, how are you doing today? Why don't we grab coffee? Why don't we catch up on what you're doing? So there's that skill set. The other thing I find, because I'm working in workplace harassment investigations, I think everyone thinks that, oh, you know, they're all separate. Harassment doesn't happen anymore. Oh no, it happens. It's worse. Like, it's almost worse at points because you say things over text or email that you wouldn't necessarily say in person. Plus, we're all tired. Like, we're all super tired of COVID and testy and short-tempered. And so we say things that we wouldn't necessarily normally say as well. So it's that conflict training, like the conflict management as well, I think becomes extremely important. I do think it's a leadership training in a different environment. And it's the other piece I think that is critical, that those that have succeeded through COVID have done well, and those that haven't probably did it poorly, and that's communication. It's communication. You cannot under-communicate. And it's okay to say you don't have the answers, especially when we're going through something like COVID. We don't have the answers. There are no standard operating procedures, no manual for this and how we get through it. So the answer is you have to communicate and say, we know there's an issue. Here's the issue we've identified. We're working on a solution. We'll get back to you. Mm. Or acknowledging, we know this isn't perfect. We know this is hard. We're working on, you know, coming up with solutions, and we will communicate with you. But silence generates fear. Silence generates all kinds of anxiety. Like, we are our own worst enemy sometimes, the negative thinking, the story that we tell ourselves. And sometimes when leadership is silent, those things and that negativity can get amplified because we don't have someone telling us that it's okay. And that, you know, the fact that no one's checked in on us, or we missed a deadline maybe because, you know, we're in a different world and maybe we're homeschooling kids, right? When we were doing that, we'll beat ourselves up over those things and not necessarily know that leadership is understanding that. So I think that communication piece is incredibly, incredibly important through this. You know, Matt, I applaud you for saying at the outset of this that you said, you know, we're definitely not going back. Like, it's going to be a new normal. Part of the training that I think has to happen is there are people that believe we will go back to the old normal because there are people that don't like, in this world, there are people that don't like change. I used to be one of them. I was raised by two people that cannot manage change at all. They don't like it at any cost. But the fact is, so those people will grasp onto the fact that we have to go back to the old normal. Mm. We've got to find a way to give people like that support so that they can. And I think this is a little bit where the resilience piece comes in as well, so that they can handle change and they can accept the change to the new normal. Mm-hmm. Because there are people, I've already seen plenty of evidence. There are a lot of people that believe we can go back. And I truly believe that we can't. We've learned too much. Things have changed too much. The dynamic, the work culture dynamic, I think is forever changed because of the COVID realities.
Mm-hmm.
So that resilience and change management piece is really, really key.
What an amazing, great answer. Oh, I'm going to be going back to this over again, that answer, taking notes. This conversation has been just fantastic. I think it's time for our rapid fire questions, Donna.
Oh, dear.
I agree. We'll start with, maybe easy, maybe not, depending on your approach. But what is your favorite or your most recommended book?
I'm going to just say one that sort of sticks out in my mind that kind of just hit me, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, or a book, it's a play, I guess, called Every Brilliant Thing. It's a stage play that is incredible. So highly recommend. I kind of go for the ones that, make me feel something.
Very cool.
Maybe that's after 24 years of a desk job. Anyways, I digress.
What was the play again? Sorry.
Every Brilliant Thing.
Okay.
Those are two titles that we haven't heard yet. So that's the.
Oh, excellent.
I'm excited. Okay.
Stage play, go see Lehman Trilogy if you ever get the chance. It's okay. Playing in New York right now. I would say that's the best, most incredible staging I've ever seen. A bit nerdy, the Lehman Brothers story. It's a bit biz, but from an artistic set standpoint and three actors playing the entire family through multiple generations, it's incredible.
Very cool. That's just my thoughts. What about your favorite movie or binging?
Life is Beautiful.
Oh, well, nice.
I guess, the theme, it's the being able to be in a bad situation and see it in a positive light or to make, is inspiring, especially when you grew up with a negative lens. We can grow.
What would your advice be to your 25-year-old self?
Oh, dear, do we have all day? I would tell my 25-year-old self a whole heck of a lot, starting with laugh more, because I didn't back then. I've learned to now. Don't take things so seriously, because, man, did I ever take things like way too seriously. So learning to relax and enjoy the journey. I would explain to my 25-year-old self that it's important to master the ability to accept uncertainty and change and persevere in failure as one of the best learning experiences you'll ever have. So it's really around that is turning the negative into the positive.
Mm. When you think of the word success, who comes to mind and why?
My kids, because they're the best thing that I ever did. I did not want to become, I've even admitted to them, horrible mom. I didn't want to be a parent. I wanted to be a business person. A lot of women are like, I want nothing more to get married and have kids. I was like, no, I want to have a successful career. In the end, I met my husband who loves kids. He said he wanted to have 8 because he knew if he took the unreasonable position he had, wanted to have 8 and I wanted 0. We ended up with 2. But yeah, I would say in terms of success, having kids. Success to me isn't about a person. It's more about elements of people. And the definition, I think, of success for me has evolved. I mean, we'd all say a Barack Obama is the definition of a success, right? Or an Oprah Winfrey or, Angela Merkel. There's all kinds of people. But I think that evolution of how you define success changing is really important. There's career success, family success, balance. So to me, someone who's successful is someone who's really loving life all around and is multidimensional. So I feel successful when I'm succeeding in many different areas in my life, which means I'm getting downtime. I'm enjoying the work that I do, and I'm only doing the work that I do. Although, let's admit it, we all have to clean toilets sometimes. Whatever, insert here. Mm-hmm. We have to do some work that we don't love. But by and large, I love the work that I'm doing now. And I loved it at the time when I was doing corporate restructuring, things like that. It's when you stop loving it, you need to move on. So I think success is more a concept than sort of wrapped up into one person that I want to be. I want to be elements of people.
What a great answer.
I love that.
What a way to end the podcast for now. Hopefully we always say to be continued.
Excellent.
We really look forward to the next one. Shelley, thanks so much for the conversation, taking the time and doing what you are doing in the world. Your work is so important and thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I mean, to me, it was about what I do now. It's about trying to make a difference. And feeling like at the end of the day, if I've made a difference in someone's lives and I can change it, or I can be a cautionary tale, quite frankly, as well, and make someone not hit burnout, or have a better bottom line because they sort of recognize the inherent costs of stress and burnout, then I've achieved what I set out to do. And that's part of what makes me happy. So thanks a lot for having me. It's been a fun experience. It was certainly fortuitous meeting Donna on that course.
Awesome.
And we'll keep talking about the analogies and how we get performance optimization out of people.
Absolutely.
And before we let you go, where can people find you?
They can find me at NAVCT, NAVCT.ca.
Okay.
It's Navigation Consulting and Training website. My email is Shelley, Shelly, at NAVCT, NAVCT.ca.
Fantastic. We'll put that in the show notes too. Shelley, thanks so much. And looking forward to the next one.
Super. Nice meeting you.